Hey there, and welcome back to Developing Developers for another episode of Digging Deeper. It has been an awesome few months getting to learn from those with vital roles in the development process. Unfortunately, we're not done yet. Today is exciting because I'm welcoming back my very first podcast guest, Brant Murdoch, who I now work with directly on the Tembi Partners team. As a partner of Tembi Partners, Brant is a part of the development process from start to finish. But given his background, his sweet spot is leading the team through the investment and financial side of the projects. So today, I wanted to take the time to learn more specifically about capital stack, which I know is crucial for a developer to understand. So Brant, welcome back, and thank you for joining me today.
Thank you. Good morning. Glad to be back.
So in case people haven't heard the first episode, can you just give a quick rundown of your career experience and what you're doing now?
Sure. So you mentioned what I'm doing now with Tembi Partners. I actually started off my career in banking. I spent a number of years in New York and in Charlotte, far too many probably to count, doing all sorts of roles in the banking world, from structured finance to commercial finance to securitizations and all sorts of goofy structures to private equity related financings and so forth. Then I spent a number of years at a family office, where we purchased assets here in the U.S., both real estate and invested into private equity. And so obviously that all translates into Tembi Partners and what we do here at Tembi Partners, which is obviously development and acquisitions. And so it's kind of a natural fit for me to be sort of the lead, if you will, as we put together structures to either fund a project or to acquire a project. So.
Yeah, thank you for that. That's awesome. And I know I've learned a lot from you in the last almost year that I've been working directly with you. So I'm excited to jump into more specifically capital stack. It sounds exciting. And I know we talked about last time how capital stack is debt and equity, and that's what's needed to pay for a project. So could we talk a little bit about what exactly is debt and equity, what those terms kind of defined?
Yeah, so this topic, you can get really into the weeds really fast. I'm going to try to hit it at a more high level, but if you want, feel free to just drill down on any particular topic of interest. But generally speaking, the term capital stack just refers to how you're going to pay for something. The way I think of it is, if you go back to, you think of a bar chart, right? And you think of multiple colors on a bar chart, and each of those represents a different portion or percentage, if you will, of the whole. Same thing with respect to debt and equity. There's 1,000 different ways to structure debt and equity, to slice it. There's all sorts of nomenclature that is nuanced within each of those. And we'll touch on some of those. But essentially, if you think about a project, and maybe I'll just do this, we'll just say the project costs are $100. Somehow that $100, you know, has to be paid for. And so it's typically some combination of debt and equity. Debt being, think about, for instance, your home, right? You're going to go buy a home. You're going to have to put probably 20% down. That debt, that senior debt, is what they'll refer to it as, or your mortgage, is going to be 80% of the value. So in our example of $100, the debt is, or the lender's debt, or the senior debt, or the mortgage is $80. And then if you think of a different color on top of that bar chart, the $20 would be the cash that you're going to bring to the table, or the equity, if you will. So generally speaking, the debt is what is provided by a third party. They are the least risky part. And if you think about risk, everything's based and priced off of risk. You hear about, you know, things that are more risky should have a greater return. Things that are less risky should have a less return. The mortgage, if you think about, again, going back to the house, your mortgage, you know, up until recently could have been 3%, 4%, 5%. Right now, obviously, with the Fed doing what the Fed's doing, it could very well be 6 or 7, or even in the future higher than that. It certainly has been in the past, going back 20, 30 years. So, nevertheless, that is not an expensive piece of the capital stack. It's actually typically the cheapest. They're secured. There's a mortgage filed. There's a lien filed. And so the bank could force you out of your home, theoretically, if you didn't make payment. Same thing with you know, when you're developing a project or putting up a project, the bank holds the cards. You need to make payments on that. And if you don't, they can foreclose and they could wipe out your equity, your cash, take control of the project and sell it to hopefully recoup their losses. That's the power that they're in. They're in the most senior position. And you hear it called, you know, senior debt, senior leverage, senior loan. Again, a lot of different names for it. But the bank that is making the loan is going to be the safest, in the safest position. And so their interest rate or what they charge is going to be the lowest because they're at the least risk. Mm-hmm. As you go further up that bar chart, as you go to, say, for instance, mezzanine, or you go to preferred equity, or you go to straight equity or common equity, again, all sorts of different names for different twists upon the idea of equity, the riskier it gets. And so those people are going to have a greater return or require a greater return. So it kind of flows out on the spectrum. The further you go out into equity, the more riskier it gets, the higher the cost of that capital. You'll hear that often times when you get into the weeds is, what's my cost of capital? What's my blended cost of capital? Meaning, what's the blended cost of my project across debt and equity as a percentage? So these are all things that as you dig down into a project and as you're trying to size it out, figure out if it's a go or no go, you got to take these into account. And as you move these pieces around, as you get more debt, it lowers your cost of capital on an overall basis. As you put more equity in, and lower the risk to the lender, it's going to cost more because your equity is going to require a greater return. It's greater risk. So there's a lot of different ways to slice it, but generally speaking, there's a long-winded answer. That's the difference between debt and equity and the interplay.
Well, thank you. And now that you mention those kind of specific types of debt and equity, could you quickly just define, I know senior debt, it sounds like would be from a bank.
Typically.
And then mezzanine debt would be...
So this is where it gets a little goofy. So you're right. Your senior debt is almost always from a bank. And sometimes that's a local community bank. Sometimes it's a credit union. Sometimes it's a regional bank. And sometimes it's a big money center bank, a Chase or a Bank of America. And honestly, it could even go so as far as to there are even funds out there that just provide debt. They're a little bit more expensive and they're a little unique, but sometimes projects call for that. So let's just go ahead with that previous example of the $100 project, right? Mm-hmm. So everything starts off, I need to understand what my project costs are. So if I know my projects, you know, I pencil it all out, I do all the analysis, I, you know, figure out what are those costs and all that, and it comes out to $100, great. Now I can go and I can start to figure out my capital stack. I need to figure out what's my risk tolerance as the owner. Do I want to put a lot of cash in this? Do I want to put as little cash as possible and get the highest return on my cash investment? There's no right or wrong answer. A lot of it comes down to the first step is the bank will sort of dictate what they're comfortable with. So they want to make sure that they have, if you have, let's say, a $10 a month payment, that there's going to be ample cash flows when the project is stabilized to make that $10 a month payment. Mm-hmm. Typically, what they're going to do is say, hey, I want $10, I want $11 for every, you know, $10. So, or I want, you know, $12 or $13. So there's this concept of a debt service coverage that they're going to want to see that they're going to be adequately protected. And then they're going to base their size of their loan off of that. Again, depending on how you feel as a sponsor of the project, you can lean on that bank and ask them to go a little bit more aggressive, or you could say, no, no, I'm going to put more cash in. And there's a bunch of different ways, and we can talk about that, but there's a bunch of different ways to do that. But at the end of the day, let's go back to that example. $100 is my project cost. Bank comes in and says, you know what, I'm comfortable doing in this instance, let's not use 80 because that's a little bit aggressive. That's good for a home loan, but that's a different type of thing. When you're talking about a development project, you're probably talking about something in the 70% range, maybe 75%, maybe a little less in some projects, whether it's speculative or whether it's already pre-leased or pre-sold, you might have a greater leverage point. But let's just use 75% for today's discussion. So a senior lender comes in, I'm going to give you 75%. That means I've got to solve for 25%, right? The balance. Mm-hmm. So as the owner, I may say, well, gosh, you know, that's a lot of cash. I don't have $25 to put into this thing. I've got maybe $20 to put in. Okay, well, that means I've got a $5 gap there that I've got to come up with. I can go a couple different routes with that. I can go to a mezzanine lender Mezzanine lenders are, gosh, they kind of write their own rules. It's this Wild West, if you will, both mezzanine and preferred equity, and they kind of are interchangeable. The only difference being mezzanine has a little bit more control over if you don't make payment versus a preferred equity, they have a little bit less control. That's just a generic simplification. But at the end of the day, one leans more towards a senior lender type of situation, which would be the mezzanine, and the other leans a little bit more towards the cash equity, which would be the preferred equity. But I might go to a fund that might provide mezzanine debt. There are banks that will provide mezzanine debt. It doesn't happen often, but they will. They're going to require a greater return. So let's say in our example, the senior lender is willing to give you a loan at 5% for that 75%. That's great. Then I'm going to have a little bit riskier piece of mezzanine financing, perhaps, and maybe that's at 9% at that $5 that's there. Mm-hmm. But my $20, I'm going to want a pretty good return on that. That's a pretty risky bet for me. So I want maybe 20%, or the equity is going to want 20% return, or maybe 30% return. Mm-hmm. So it dials up dramatically the further you go up the stack in terms of the risk and in terms of the return that they require. And then preferred equity, just to touch on that really quick, is just maybe a quasi type of situation where they might not require the equity returns of 20 or 30%. Maybe it's a 15%, maybe it's a 14, maybe it's 18%. Kind of project specific, kind of return and risk specific. But you can structure that risk out. So if I want to give them a little bit more power and reduce their risk, they may be comfortable with a lower return. And there are a lot of developers that will do just that. They may put a huge chunk of preferred equity or mezzanine in the middle of a deal between the cash equity and the senior debt. Because if you can get, you know, them to come in at 15% and your project's going to return, you know, maybe 30%, then you're still, you're levering up your project to a positive return to the equity, which is a long-winded way of saying, you know, you're basically using other people's money to make more mm-hmm, money. Mm-hmm. But again, there's trade-offs for all this, right? Yeah. So you can absolutely get too cute and find yourself, you know, in a pickle and ultimately out of control of your own project, which is not a good place to be.
So just to review really quick, we have our $100, 75 of that is the senior debt.
Yep.
And then we have 5, which is mezzanine.
Sure.
And the 20 is equity. That is, yeah, other people's money that are investing, or your own, into the project cost.
Typically, you're going to want to put some of your own cash. I mean, it does happen. I've seen it, but it's pretty shocking that you wouldn't have the sponsor, the owner of a project, put in at least something, because you want to see them invested. Mm-hmm. I mean, listen, I would never invest in somebody's deal if they weren't putting a meaningful chunk in themselves. Mm-hmm. Meaningful meaning, and again, that's a relative term, you know, a decent chunk of money that they wouldn't want to walk away from, mm-hmm, right? It's not $25,000. It's a chunk of money, right? A big chunk of money. And so you want to have everybody vested and pulling in the right direction. And the first way you do that, in my view, is that the owner and the sponsor of the project, they sit at the end of the line. They're the last ones to get their money out. They're the most risky money. And that's, to me, that's how it should be done. Again, I'm not casting, you know, shadows on anybody else, but generally speaking, I think most developers feel the same way, is that, okay, if we're all going to be aligned, I'm going to sit at the end of the line. And I may bring other people's money in to help me get this project done because, you know, for instance, Tempe Partners, maybe I'm doing 5 deals at once, mm-hmm, 5 development deals at once. That's a lot of cash. I mean, that literally could be $50 million in cash. Candidly, I have $50 million sitting on the sidelines. So, but do we have a good chunk that we can put in and then bring in preferred equity into each of the deals? Yeah, absolutely, mm-hmm, we can do that. And so as long as people are aligned properly, then I think that that's okay to bring in preferred equity to shore up. So in that example, let's go a little further. Let's say we've, mm-hmm, got the 75, then we've got, let's just collapse the mezzanine and call it preferred equity.
Okay.
Maybe you have $75 of the 100 for your senior debt. Then you've got, let's call it 10% or another $10 worth of preferred equity. And that takes me to 85%. And then maybe I'm putting in 15% cash. Mm-hmm. And maybe I've structured my preferred equity in such a way that I've de-risked and given all sorts of rights to the preferred equity and given them an opportunity to be taken out early or give them a put option to take them out early to de-risk them, they might be okay with a mid-teens return, particularly when you look at, you know, the investment world these days, right? The equity markets are melting down. Mm-hmm. That might be a great return for somebody. So everything's relative. Everything mm-hmm. kind of depends on the market, depends on demand, depends on risk, and is priced accordingly.
Yeah, that makes sense. And that goes into a lot of different things that I wanted to cover. So that's awesome. And when exactly does that process begin of putting together the capital stack? When is that triggered by a project? And what are the different ways to come up with that cost? I know there's a budget at some point mm-hmm. and you have your money in the bank. And how do you know like how much you're able to put into a project and the ultimate cost that you're going to need to
collect. It's interesting. So for those Excel junkies out there, there's the concept of, and we've all seen it, I'm sure, a circular reference, right? Mm-hmm. It's the worst, mm-hmm. Which is you have to build in some assumptions into your model to account for the capital stack. They might not be perfect. In fact, they're not going to be because you don't have answers yet. But as you're modeling it out and figuring out, okay, what are my total costs for this project? You need to make some educated guesses. And so it all starts with the development budget. The development budget is the cost, the all-in cost to construct, to build, to stabilize, to pay out leasing fees, to manage, everything you would expect to have to expend through the life of a project. And again, let's go back to that example. Maybe that adds up perfectly to $100. Great. Doesn't quite work like that, but let's use that as an example. Mm-hmm. It starts with a fully baked, as we would call it, development budget. Once I have that, then I can start to have conversations. And I'm always thinking about it anyways. I can start to have conversations about, okay, are we feeling good about this project? Is it a risky project? Is it not a risky project? And different lenders will naturally gear themselves towards different types of projects. And so you've got to be conscious. You'd like to have a couple different banks that you work with that are what I would call house or relationship banks. And in our instance, I actually go and do that work ourselves, just given my background. A lot of groups will use a broker or a placement agent. There's some fantastic ones that are out there. Even here in Columbus, there's great ones. There's, you know, Walker Dunlop, there's Bellwether, there's a couple other placement agents in town who will do work one-off, but great, great groups, and they will help find that bank that is the right institution to start with. And so it usually does start with a bank. So you're going to find your senior debt first, and then you're going to kind of see where they size out in terms of they say, okay, I'm going to give you 75%. They may come back and say, hey, we're really locked down right now. We're at 55% on this project. Well, then my work's cut out for me because then I've got to go find a way to make this project work and deliver the returns I need to the equity providers. And that gets more complicated. So then you really, you know, have to start thinking, do I need to bring in mezz? Do I need to bring in preferred equity? Do we kill this project? A lot of projects die on the vine when the senior lender comes back and says no go, especially in an amendment like this where the Fed is raising rates and banks are pulling back. We just had a conversation the other day about a lot of projects are sort of, you know, they're dying right now. They're just put on hold. They're shelved. And that happens because your best money is going to be your senior debt. It's going to be the cheapest. It's going to be what allows you to get the project done in a profitable manner. So if those lenders aren't there, that makes everything an uphill battle. So from there, again, you know, you kind of start working with your senior debt, figure out where that is, and then start filling in the balance of the puzzle. And then, you know, you're adjusting your model and your returns accordingly based on how that fills itself out.
Mm-hmm. And so once you kind of put together that budget and decide this project is feasible and you get your capital stack and you're ready to move forward with that project, what does a developer need to do or what do they need to track leading up to the repayment of the loan?
Yeah. So you're talking about a construction budget. Lenders can be all over the board on this. So generally speaking, lenders want to have construction and stabilization of a project is the riskiest part of a lender's book, right? So when they're putting out a loan, that's where they're really nervous, right? Mm-hmm. They want the thing stabilized. It's not hard for them to put out a loan on something that's fully leased. So what a lender will oftentimes do is say, hey, let's put a construction loan out there for you, and then let's give you some runway thereafter, 2, 3, 4, 5, maybe even 10 years. And that's called a mini perm, meaning it's a mini permanent financing after you've developed and after you've stabilized the asset. And so what do we track? We track everything, and we got to report on everything. So I need to be ultra transparent, ultra communicative with the lender because they're my lifeline. Everything starts with them. And so every month, I'm putting together a draw based on how I draw funds from the loan to fund the construction. So let's say I've got to order the steel package, or I've got to order, you know, I've got to pay for the electricians, or I've got to, you know, pour the pad. All those things are done, and then you submit draws. And so it's tracked literally line item by invoice, line item by line item, and invoice by invoice. And so there's somebody on the bank side who's doing the same thing. And so there's a reconciliation each month to make sure everybody's seeing eye to eye. And then once a project is done and you're not drawing on that loan anymore, obviously I make my payments, right? So if I'm, depending on how the loan's structured, generally speaking, I'm going to make interest payments for a little while, and then I'm going to make principal payments and interest payments. And that goes back to the point where I said earlier, if I have a $10 payment, the bank wants to make sure that at some point, you know, usually within a year or two, I've got that thing stabilized and I'm cash flowing enough that I can, you know, show that I've earned $13 and okay, great. So I've got $13 of cash in from my tenants, and now I've got to pay my loan back this month of $10. That means I get to keep $3 in that instance. And maybe that goes to, I don't know, maybe it goes to the mezz, maybe it goes to preferred equity. Maybe it just sits there as a reserve for conservatism on the balance sheet. But at the end of the day, my senior lender is my lifeline. So mm-hmm. it's all about constant communication with them. I personally put together a quarterly update for our investors, and I always send that to the senior lender as well. I think it's just good practice because, listen, everybody reports to somebody. The senior lender is going to report to his boss and his credit committee, or her boss, her credit committee, maybe their board if it's a small group. But at the end of the day, the best thing you can do is arm them to let them know what's going on, because there will be a project when something goes sideways. And when it goes sideways, you need to have a trust already established there. That lender needs to know that you're going to do right by them. You're not going to jam them, you know, unless it really is truly the worst possible scenario. So you're going to do everything you can to fight your way out of a bad situation. So to me, transparency and communication with the lender is so, so critical, almost more critical than anybody else, quite frankly.
Yeah, I would agree. If you're updating them, they then trust that you're going to let them know if something is not going well. So if you say it's all good, they can trust that it's all good.
Yeah. And the truth of the matter is there will be times. I mean, it just takes time. There's, you know, this is a game of numbers, and eventually statistics suggest that you're probably going to have an oopsie. And that doesn't mean an oopsie that's not fixable, but you're going to have an oops. It's going to need to be addressed. I mean, we had a project out of town that, gosh, I don't even know what it was in terms of dollar magnitude, but it was $1 million oops. And it was nothing that anybody could have foreseen or accounted for. All of our diligence was proper. It was right. But there was literally a stream that ran through the middle of the site underground that none of the borings picked up. It literally snaked around the borings. So it was one of those where it's like, oh, gosh, this is terrible. Mm-hmm. It's $1 million that isn't in the budget that we don't have. And so on Christmas Eve or Christmas Day, I can't even recall, of last year, we were working through this problem. But the first call that we made was to the lender to say, hey, just a heads up, we're going to figure this one out and solve it. But this is what's going on. And they said, no problem. Let us know how we can help. Ultimately, we fixed the problem. And it wasn't ultimately, it didn't end up being $1 million, but quite a bit less. But they gave us the latitude to go ahead and solve it and fix the problem and have the time without feeling like the lender's breathing down our neck and not going to advance the next advance because of this $1 million hole, which wasn't accounted for. They just kept going at business as usual. They trusted us. And that was built on the rapport that we had already established with them. Mm-hmm. So that's the place you want to be, because those things will happen.
Mm-hmm. That's a great example. And I know we We've talked about the different kinds of debt and the different kinds of equity. Could you touch on the different ways that you pay that back to them? So I know there's a waterfall model that is used often.
Yeah, the infamous waterfall. Everybody talks about it. So the waterfall is, just to touch on that, because that's where it all starts. Mm-hmm. So in an operating agreement or in a development agreement, the waterfall is basically the reader's instructions on how to, you know, advance to the next step. And so it's usually, I mean, it can be one or two steps, or it could be as long and as creative as you want it to be. And I've seen them really brutally long. Basically, though, the waterfall speaks to the lender will set the term of their loan, right? Mm-hmm. So most lenders don't put anything out there past 10 years. Most are probably more comfortable in the 5-year range, some even shorter than that. So that's going to dictate that that needs to be repaid or refinanced at some point down the line. Your waterfall speaks to what happens after that's accounted for. So after you've paid for your senior loan, and let's just use this as an example as a sales process. So let's say I've stabilized this project. It's been a great success. I've paid my interest and principal throughout the loan, and maybe it's not even the loan maturity, but I say, gosh, the market's great. I'm going to sell this project. Okay, great. So our $100 development project now is going to sell for $200, let's just say, for argument's sake. So go back to our example there on a $75 advance from the lender, from the senior loan. I need to pay back that $75. Okay, great. So I've got $100 of profit. I'm going to go ahead and pay that $75 back. That's great. Step two in the waterfall, and I'm simplifying some things here. So there's nuances within that where the interest has to be repaid first and then principal. There's all sorts of goofy little nuances there. But the gist of it is the waterfall tells you where you take the next payment to. Mm-hmm. So in this instance, we went $75 to the senior. Then the next $10, I think let's use that example where I said, okay, we've got $10 preferred equity. That's going to be driven by what I've agreed to with the preferred equity provider. There might be a lockout there. There might be where I can't repay them, or there might be a premium for early repayment. That's where it's fuzzy because there's no set way of doing it. Mm-hmm. It's an agreement between the equity, the sponsor, the owner, and the providers. So it's negotiated, and there's no rights or wrongs. And again, it's finding that balance. It goes back to the risk and reward balance. But essentially, the waterfall in step two is going to say, okay, I've paid off my senior lender. Now I'm going to go and address either my mezzanine or my preferred equity. In that case, it's $10. Great. Okay. Let's pay them back. And maybe in that instance, I owe them the original $10 plus 50%. So another $5. Okay, great. So that means that's $15 out the door to those guys. Then I'm coming down to, you know, and again, there could be other nuances, other series in there of preferred equity. But at the end of the day, that waterfall is going to dictate where the next payment goes. And most common, it's going to go to the common equity. But the waterfall, if you think about it, and it derives itself from an Excel spreadsheet. If you've ever seen one of these laid out in a development pro forma or even any type of model, the waterfall will actually step down. It almost looks like a ladder. And so it's imagine the water falling over one set of rocks, hitting the next rock, falling over the next set. So it literally does, in a non-creative manner, look like a waterfall for us nerds who look at too much Excel. But that's hence the reason, you know, both the analogy and the reality of it, right? It's telling you, okay, pay these guys off, then where? Then these guys, then these guys, and these guys. And so ultimately it gets down to the common equity. And at that point, you've wrapped it up, you finished up. So
that makes a lot of sense. And I think it is funny thinking about someone looking at it and saying, what should we call this? Well, it looks like a waterfall. That sounds good. But, and then that also speaks to the fact that you're not going to be paid until the other investors are paid above you. And so it gives them security that you're not going to want to put money into something that's not going to work. And
well, that's exactly it. So the other way to look at it, another way to say this really briefly, is that your waterfall starts at the top at the people that should be exposed to the least amount of risk, meaning your senior lender, right? They're the senior most, you know, priority of payment. And then it starts flowing down the hill, down the waterfall, if you will, mm-hmm. to the people who are bearing the most risk, mm-hmm. which ultimately will be your equity, your common equity, your owner, if you will, in our previous example. So, and again, it's a risk thing, right? It's a risk reward. So you're trying to be as protective as possible to your lender and then to your mezz and then your preferred, then to your common equity or your ownership equity, if you will.
Mm-hmm. And I think we've sort of packaged up capital stack into, I know you can't really put it in a box. It's not like a one and done type thing where there's a certain formula and you follow that. But I have a better understanding of it, I feel like. And so I think that other people can at least take this and could move forward with putting together capital stack if they needed to
start somewhere. It's probably worth noting that of all the deals we've done, I don't think that there's two that look mm-hmm. perfectly similar. Mm-hmm. Everything is in our world is one off. Could we simplify it a little bit? Yeah, you could. But at the end of the day, the development world just requires you to be a little bit more. It's not high volume. It's more nuanced. It's more boutique-y. Mm-hmm. So at least that's my take on it. So I can't look at any. I mean, even our senior lenders, like, I'll have one senior lender do two deals within a month of each other that are so substantially similar, but even their terms and their interest rate are going to be just a little bit different each time. Mm-hmm. Because ultimately, every deal is going to model out a little differently. And so every risk is a little bit different. And that only gets amplified even more so the further out and further down the capital stack you go. So it's going to get even more nuanced and more individual based on, the further out you go in the risk spectrum. So the common equity or the preferred equity is going to get, goofier and funkier each time. And that's okay. So it's not cookie cutter. It makes it a little bit exhaustive in that sense because it takes a lot of time to put this all together. But that's also, you gotta embrace that. It's mm-hmm. part of the fun too. I mean, it is a critical piece, just as important as that steel that, holds the roof up. Mm-hmm. You have to get this part of the project right.
Yeah, absolutely. Got to be flexible. So I have one last question for you. And last year, I know that I asked you some advice to leave us with, and you left us with the advice to continuously ask the question, what can we do better? And so I want to ask you, bring it full circle, what have you learned to do better in the last year that developing developers might learn from?
Big pause there. So I feel like every day I'm learning. I mean, I do feel like every day is a new experience. I feel like there's left hooks coming all the mm-hmm. time, whether it's $1 million river running through the middle of a site that we didn't know about or foresee. Recently, I learned a ton about underground detention at a really constrained site, infill site that we're working on in Columbus. Just another example, I've learned a lot about demoing pavement. We're looking at another infill site right now that would have a multi-million-dollar demo cost to remove pavement, which is just, who knew? And what's that process look like? So there's a lot of things that I'm individually learning. I will say that on a macro level, I've continued to get better at learning how to say no. I like to say yes. But at the end of the day, there's only so many hours in the day. So we've got to use our time. It's the best and only resource we have that we can really count on and control. So learning to say no to projects that are just not quite what they should be in terms of risk or reward, or frankly, interesting. And so learning to say no has been a big one. And I'll continue to struggle with that because I want to say yes to everything. Mm-hmm. But I will say that as part of that, it's also embracing the work-life balance. Most of us have in this industry have a pretty strong type A, which means we just want to go, go, go. So the last 12 months have been incredibly busy. We've been more busy than I even like to think about, but all the more important to balance that out. So as the intensity at work increases, the intensity of your play needs to increase or your relaxation needs to increase. And so you can't get fried. And so I've learned a lot about that. And I want to encourage our team to be really conscientious of that. you know, family should come first in everybody's lives. I truly, truly do believe that. You know, there's Columbus recently lost an incredible developer here in town to an accident that was terribly unfortunate. And fortunately, the gentleman was doing what he loves doing. So I guess that's the beauty of it. And he just a fantastic human being. So, but I think about that and it makes me want to further lean into, you know, my family and making mm-hmm. sure that, you know, I'm spending the time that I want to spend with them. Obviously, I want to spend all the time with them. But at the end of the mm-hmm. day, also, I've got a 5-year-old, so I do need a breather. and a 13-year-old, which also requires a different type of breather. But so, you know, learning to get better at that work-life balance. Mm-hmm. And a couple of macro things I think I'll note here. We're in a super tightening cycle here with the Fed. They just raised on a third time, 75 basis points. And what that's doing to the market in terms of the capital markets, meaning the lenders and the equity and all those things in the capital stack we're talking about. There is a mantra in the investment world that is don't fight the Fed, meaning when the Fed is loosening, when they're printing money, when they're reducing rates, when they're quantitative easing, things are good. Roll with it, right? But when they're tightening, like they're doing right now, you got to be really mindful because that can pivot really fast. And we've watched in the last 6 months, the markets go from incredible, actually maybe a little bit longer, 6 months, last 9 months, in once in a lifetime type of market to March starting to really turn off the spigot. And it's really, really accelerated in the last couple of months. So don't fight the Fed. So I've been around long enough to know that I've seen 08, I've seen 01. This will pass. It's going to be a rough patch, but you can't let the noise of the markets cloud your thinking. But at the end of the day, you also have to be conscious. It's going to be a little bit of a rough patch. So you got to have the long view, take the long view. So I'm working on that. I'm learning to try to heed my own advice there. As I was driving in, having a conversation with somebody on our team earlier, I was kind of, you know, kind of chuckling that it's a tough time right now, depending on where you are. We're watching deals fall to the wayside, as I mentioned earlier, left and right. So, you know, we can't let the noise cloud our strategy. I literally was speaking that to our colleague, but at the same time, trying to convince myself of that. So it's something I struggle with. But this too will pass. So
yeah, well, that's a good reminder. I think it's majorly helpful for developing developers of the world to hear someone who's further along in their career, not by much, right?
But I don't know. I'm 47.
To remind us that all of those things matter. Work-life balance. It's okay to say no. The things that, as you're young, it's probably harder to find that important and you want to work your way up. And so yeah. It's good to be reminded of that.
Yeah, that's tough. I mean, yeah. I get it. I mean, I was in my 20s and I was in my 30s and I absolutely remember, you know, you're trying to climb that ladder. You're trying to establish yourself. You want to buy a house. Mm-hmm. You want to do this. You want to do that. All those things are great. That's the American dream. Do it, you know, let it rip. But at the same time, take care of yourself, mm-hmm. right? Have some downtime, have some passions outside of the office. It's critical. Yeah. Otherwise, you'll just fry.
Yeah, we don't want that.
Not
good. Well, thank you so much again for coming back and sharing more of your knowledge with us.
Thank you.